Today's podcast is sponsored by MPB, the online pricing engine that provides the right price for any camera or lens. Get free kit pickup and get paid within days, all without leaving your home. How much could you get? Find out with a free instant quote at www.mpb.com/sell.
Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 14th of August. I'm Phil Hinton, and tonight I'm joined by our podcast regulars. We've got Ian Collin, Julian Scott, Martin Dew, and Doug Piper. Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Busy show this week. We've got lots to get through. If you are joining us live, and Paul Munger is, good evening, Paul. Back at you there. If you're watching live, the chat window is open, so get your questions in. We'll try and answer those as we go along tonight. If you're not watching us live, and the majority of you catch up during the week, then, of course, you can ask your questions in the podcast forum underneath this podcast, and we'll get round to answering them the following time that the podcast comes on. We've got some comments to go through from the last podcast as well. Tonight, so what are we talking about? Well, tonight I'll be talking about the first Panasonic TV that I've seen this year, first OLED from Panasonic. That's the MZ980. The review is now live on the homepage. If you want to go and follow through, you can do that. And as we talk about it, you can follow in the review. Martin's going to be talking about the Primeir 8-channel amplifier. Doug's going to take us through two sets of home cinema speaker packages. So we'll look forward to that. One from Klipsch and one from Ascendo. Never heard of Ascendo, but seems to be getting a bit of a following. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on. You will notice that Ed's not here tonight. Sadly, there is no hi-fi section. Ed's feeling a little bit under the weather, a little bit poorly. He's not sure what it is. It could be COVID. He's not feeling actually ill. He just can't talk for coughing at the moment. So on a podcast where you have to talk, that probably wouldn't work very well. So we wish Ed a speedy recovery. He won't be here tonight. So we've got no hi-fi section tonight, but there's plenty of us on here and we've all got our own little areas of expertise. So we'll try and keep you entertained for the usual time length tonight. And like I say, we'll be answering your questions in the chat, and Ian will be giving us a roundup of all the TV and home cinema news as well. If you are a little bit later on listening to us and so on, and you don't have access to the forums, you can, of course, email us, podcast@avforums.com, send your questions through there, or send your feedback. What do you think of the AV Forums podcast? Are we covering everything you'd like us to cover? Is there things you would like to see, things that you think we could maybe improve on or go into in a little bit more depth or whatever? It's always great to hear from you guys. It's always great to get a little bit of discussion going. So, yeah, let us know your thoughts. Right, so talking about feedback, we're going to go and have a look at feedback from the previous podcast. I'll get my words right tonight. From the 24th of July, and on YouTube under the Hisense U7K, a question was received that somebody had picked up a 65-inch U7KM last Friday. It's amazing value. He's had zero issues with any content from any of the devices, PS5, Xbox, etc. So it sounds like, is that Jobu9224? If I got that right, thank you very much for your feedback. Yeah, they are pretty bulletproof TVs nowadays. The review is up on AV Forums if you're interested in finding out a little bit more about the Hisense U7K. And funnily enough, sitting right next to me, well, behind me actually, over my shoulder there, is the U8K from Hisense. And the one sitting next to it right here is the TCL C845. So I've actually got the more affordable 65-inch TVs, mini LED TVs, up against each other at the minute. That review's coming soon. So keep your eyes for that as well. So home AV question. I think this one's for you, Jules. Okay. Do you want to go through it and then answer it?
Yeah, sure. Forums member Gary Och, is that Welsh or something? Gary Och asks, is there a way to safeguard your calibrated settings in the event of the display requiring a manufacturing reset? Or would it require a new calibration? My professionally calibrated TV encountered a PCB failure, which required repair under warranty. Unfortunately, the display had to be factory reset and all the calibrated settings were lost. Thank you. So, speaking of myself, I will write down all the settings, usually have a template from for each different display that I've calibrated. So your brightness, contrast, OLED light, all this kind of stuff, you can write down and go through the settings. It takes about half an hour, you know, to write down at the end of every calibration that I do. And I personally give a copy of that to the client. Other calibrators, I'm sure, do something pretty similar. You could take, as in fact, Just Bloke Toon Army suggests that he frequently photographs the settings on his various equipment as a fail-safe measure. And that's something you can also do as well. If your calibrator hasn't written them down for you and give them as a PDF, then you could take a photograph of the different screens within the settings menu, so you have that record to go back to in case it needs to be put back in again. One caveat to that is 3D LUP cannot be written down. There are thousands and thousands of adjustments, color adjustments. You just can't write that stuff down. So if you have, for example, a 3D LUP calibration on an LG TV, it's lost. So it would have to be done all over again.
Yeah, and that's because it actually writes it to the TV.
Indeed.
So, and if the TV fails, then unfortunately your LUT calibration goes with it. Jules, is there any fail safe in terms of if that doesn't work for a client of yours? Do you do discounted go back and fix it type things?
I don't think we should be taking advantage of people's misfortune. So, I certainly, probably others do as well, offer some sort of discounted recalibration, a much lower price. I had one just recently that I had to do for somebody. Their TV had to go back, lost all the settings. And so we agreed on a very, very much reduced price to redo it again.
And of course, the advice is always get a few hundred hours on a set before you get it professionally calibrated. And the reason for that is that if a set is going to go pop, it usually does so in the first few weeks or first few months of its life. So give the set time to run in, and then that's not to say it'll never fail, but if it is going to fail because of a faulty component or whatever, they normally go quite quickly.
I can say, Phil, I've been doing this professionally for many years now, and it happens very few times.
Yeah.
So, that's why I'm happy to offer a very much discounted price for a recalibration, because it doesn't happen that often that you need to do this.
Yeah. And 20 years I've had TVs coming in and out, and apart from the odd one that a courier has managed to smash, never had any issues with TVs, even long term. Never had any go wrong. So, thank you very much for your question. Hopefully that answers that one. And that's all the feedback from our last podcast, which was the 24th of July. So, like I say, if you've got any feedback whatsoever, any questions, and you are not watching us live and you don't have access to the chat window, then do so on the forums. Leave your comment underneath this podcast in the podcast forums. And the thread's already there for tonight's podcast. So go and leave your questions and we'll get around to them next time we're on. Right. So before we go any further, we need to find out what everybody's been doing since the last podcast. Doug, you've not been around for a little while now. Number of weeks since you were last on the podcast. So what have you been up to?
I've not. I was actually racking my brains while you were talking there as to what I've been doing, because I've been up to so much. What have I been doing? I went to see a band I like called First Aid Kit relatively recently in London, which was great. At a mini festival at Crystal Palace Bowl called South Facing, which was excellent. Fantastic band. The weekend before that, I went to something called the Loxwood Joust, which is like a medieval reenactment festival kind of thing that they throw annually. And there's a joust and there's all sorts of medieval reenacted battles, which was fantastic. Never been to anything like that. It's not my normal cup of tea. But I went there, I drank mead, I had a great time. It was fun. other than that, I've been podcast viewers will know the plight of my flood stricken house. That's now on the mend, and I've got to the point where it's actually dry now. I can start to rebuild it, so that's been keeping me relatively busy.
Moving house is stressful enough, never mind moving house and then having to deal with a flood immediately as you're in the process of moving house. So nice to see it you're getting it in order now and things
Finally.
For you. Wouldn't have wished that on my worst enemy. That's no funny at all. I know how stressful house moving is. So, Martin, what have you been up to?
Well, since the last podcast, a very nice holiday to Switzerland.
Excellent.
To Sonnenland region, which is basically built around a little town called Gstaad, which has some fame because it had inhabitants such as Richard Burton and a few other movie stars as well. But it's a beautiful region. And actually, I got a chance on this trip, because my family tends to go back to that region every year. I got a chance to go to Schilthorn, which is the mountain that houses Piz Gloria, which is the building that was used on the peak as Blofeld's lair in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And there's a museum up there of the movie, and it is absolutely fascinating. And I hadn't realized, actually, that Eon Productions and Cubby Broccoli, only the foundations had been built in 1968. So Eon Productions offered to finish the building specifically for the movie. And now, of course, it's this a tourist attraction. And you take four very scary, steep cable cars to get to the top. And it's intriguing.
Excellent. That sounds like great fun.
I'm calibrating out there soon, Martin.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm going to Gestad, a big, very, very high-end £500,000 projector to do.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Never been.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You'll love it. You won't want to leave.
Yeah, a guy called Blofeld owns it.
Yes.
Yeah. Ian, you managed to get out of the house?
Yes. Yeah, on two occasions as well, both football related.
Yes.
First one was I actually played football for the first time in quite some time, which went about as well as I expected it to. Not great on the pitch, not great the morning after either with the legs. And also football season started. And obviously I'm based down in Bournemouth, which makes Southampton my new championship home team. And Norwich got to play Southampton at the weekend. So I managed to get a ticket to go along to that. And was treated to an utterly tedious 4-4 draw, which was, yeah, it was both great to watch and also painful to watch in terms of the defending and my health gradually deteriorating through the last kind of 5-10 minutes of the match. But yeah, got out of the house and had good fun for it as well.
Okay, excellent. Jules, what are you up to?
Yeah, now football's back. As Ian said, I went to see Norwich against Hull for opening game of the season, and we won with a heart-stopping last-minute injury time winner. And now I've started playing again. So first pre-season game on Saturday. Got 3 assists in a 4-2 victory away. So not bad,
Excellent, excellent.
Can't move today, though.
You're training tonight, are you?
Training tonight, yeah. Trying to get to... Okay.
We'll try and get through our bit later on then, and so you can get away for training. Myself, I've not been up to much other work at the minute. Obviously, it's TV season. I've been working my weekends and so on, but I've also been keeping up with fitness regime. As most of you will know, I've been learning how to run. So another PB for me on Saturday there. I knocked a whole minute off my 5K. This time around. Obviously, it wasn't as warm and it wasn't as wet, so I managed to run really well. Down to 33 minutes now for a 5K, which I'm really quite happy with. I don't think I'll get much lower than that. I think I'm kind of reaching where I'm going to be comfortable, I think, around about that. And then I might consider upping that to 10K and adding a little bit of distance on now that I've got the pace and the weight off. So I also crossed over the 2-stone barrier. So I have lost 2 stone since coronation weekend. Been doing that. Yeah, I feel a lot better for it. I can tell you, it makes a big, big difference. Right. So I guess we're all caught up now. So current competitions. Doug's going to tell us what we can all win.
Yeah, there's lots of them. Open to everyone, you could win a Valencia Tuscany black cinema seat worth £1,400, courtesy of Valencia Home Theatre Seating. You could also win £500 to spend with MPB, which is a platform for selling and trading used photo and videographic equipment. There is also a fair selection of Blu-rays available to win. There's the horror movies Earwig and Murder Me Monster on limited edition Blu-ray from Antiworlds. There's Carmen on Blu-ray, a retelling of the famous opera, and Sister Boniface Mysteries Season 2. There are a large number of Blu-rays available, so exclusive competition offers for patrons. So Sam Peckinpah's Cross of Iron, limited edition 4K, Evil Dead Rise, limited edition 4K. If you've not seen that and you're an Evil Dead fan, you must go and watch it. It's absolutely superb. Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, and Anime Flix, One Piece Film Red, and Inuo. Can't pretend to know anything about either of those, as well as Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. There's also Super Mario Brothers movie, Justice League War World, a Donnie Yen directed and starring film, Sacra, on Blu-ray, as well as Ride On, starring Jackie Chan, Frontiers, Body Horror May, and three film collections starring legend Franco Nero, Costa Nostra, on limited edition Blu-ray. So if any of that interests you, and it should, because there's some fantastic ones there, head over to avforums.com/competitions to enter. All competitions are open to eligible AV Forums members or patrons resident in the UK.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Doug. And Martin, previous hardware competition winners?
Yes, we have Chevan's Mega Gold 5 and Bela Lugosi's dad have won the Spears and Munsell Ultra HD Benchmark Blu-ray plus LX1 bias lighting strip.
Excellent prizes. Well done, guys.
Ultra 2 Man won the Humax A1 4K Ultra HD streaming box and 3x Humax Wi-Fi smart plugs bundle.
Excellent.
Jackie Chan Wigwam won the Scalextric model of Knight Rider's KITT and Back to the Future 3's DeLorean.
There we go. Excellent. Well, well done to all our competition winners there. And talking about patrons, we have a new patron, Ian.
Yeah, this is a much shorter list. Mark B has joined us. So welcome aboard, Mark.
Yep. Thank you very much for your support, Mark. It really is appreciated. Right. Okay. Time to get on with the show. Right then, so we have some display news, Ian. Sony confirming the A95L. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, it's been announced in a few other regions for the specific details, but it's confirmed the UK specific details with the A95L QD OLED will be arriving in the UK in September, with its UK website listing a rather more specific shipping date of the 11th of September. So it should be around then. If you've ordered it, you'll be able to get your hands on one. As for pricing, things start at £2,999 for the 55-inch, going up to £3,699 for the 65-inch, with the new 77-inch model topping out at £5,999. So a little bit up on last year's pricing. Those older models probably going to be at some quite healthy discounts around about now, I'd imagine. It's also a little bit higher than the likes of the Samsung S95C, the LG G3 and Panasonic MZ2000, but it's only a little bit higher. So, you know, would it be worth the extra money? I suppose would be the big question.
Okay. Expecting one of those in for review very soon. And of course, thanks to Peter Tyson, we have some of the flagships staying around for a little length of time. So I've got a S95C and also LG G3. I've got a Panasonic MZ2000 turning up tomorrow for review. So that set's not available till next month as well. So I've got a number of those that we're going to be doing comparisons and so on. And obviously Sony is a highly anticipated TV. Highly expensive as well. So is it worth the money, like you say, Ian? Last year's set, Jules, did you get to calibrate many of those? Were many of those in homes?
I have to say, with the Panasonics, I hardly saw any. And I think it's because they came out so late in the day that the other manufacturers had just basically stolen a march on them. So it'll be nice to see some more, you know, so this year, because the Panasonic do make fantastic televisions.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a movie fan and you're not too bothered about the gaming side of things and you just want a TV for darkroom viewing, then definitely it's the way to go. LG, I got to play with this TV at Las Vegas at CES. Ian, but tell us more about it now that it's available to the market.
Yeah, it's the 97-inch Signature M OLED, which is out now in South Korea, I believe, and coming to the UK probably next month as well. It's also known as the M3 in keeping with LG's 2023 TV naming system. Obviously stands out partly because of the very, very large screen size that it comes in, but it's also the world's first wireless OLED. because it comes with LG Zero Connect box, which can host all of your cabling needs up to 10 meters away from the TV. Although, of course, the TV still needs a power cable attached, so it's not entirely wireless, but as good as. TV itself comes with much of the same feature list as LG's other key OLEDs, including the Alpha 9 Gen 6 processor and all the relevant upgrades that come with that. So it should be a good TV in that respect. As for pricing, 97-inch model for the UK market will have an RRP of £27,999. But it will come with two smaller and rather more affordable options, with an 83-inch model set to be priced at £7,999 and a 77-inch model at £5,999, which coincidentally, in linking to the previous stories, the same price as the Sony A95L 77-inch.
Right, there we go. Not sure how useful this TV would be. I mean, it's not something that I would pay the extra money for personally. I'm quite happy to connect my sources to the TV. I don't need to have the TV any great distance away from my sources. But is it something that interests you guys? Is it something that, you know, once the technology is in the market, it comes down in price? And what we're talking about here, just for those of you who don't know, it's you have one box that sits next to your sources. It's about the size of a cube, a sort of a GameCube or like an Xbox Series X. It's kind of that size of box that you connect all your sources to HDMI, and then that transmits the signal to the TV, and the TV has a box and have like a dial on top that you turn the dial so it points towards the box that it sends it wirelessly. So anybody interested in this?
I probably would be. Personally, I've got my system. Well, at the moment, they kind of coexist in the living room with my family system. But normally, I have my system. That's my dedicated system, and you know, I spend ages and thousands of pounds on it, making it as good as possible. But I also have one that my family use on a day to day basis, and I quite like having screens up on walls. I think it's a nice clean install. And for that, I would normally always chase into the wall to hide all the wires, because I hate wires being on display, and I rarely have the TV sat on top of a cabinet. So that would save me the job of doing it, which, you know, it's just cost and time that it's saving, really. Ultimately, I wouldn't have wires on display anyway. It's just saving the hassle of having to hide them.
Yeah. Jules, is there many people who still plug sources into their TVs? I'm just thinking, you know, most of it's streaming services these days. So is it an answer to a question that was never asked?
That's probably what I was going to say. But yeah, you think about it nowadays. I mean, obviously, you know, Blu-ray is going to be a thing of the past. You know, we've seen, you know, Disney pulling out of certain parts of the world. And
discuss that in a little bit.
So, you know, physical sources, and I guess you've got your Xboxes and your PlayStations and you're plugging in, but fewer now. And a lot of the, obviously, the streaming services, as you say, they're all inbuilt within the TVs. Fewer of them. Is it that much of a problem? I don't know. If it's no cost extra, then fine, go for it. But I wouldn't be paying for it myself just for that. But
I suppose you're going to have to run the power as well, aren't you? That kind of kills my
you're
point.
Chasing the power
still,
cable.
Still have to hide that. Yeah.
Well, that's a terrible username. Great username, actually. I just said in the chat, you know, both the box and the TV need power. So, you know, would that mean an extra wire? Well, yeah, it would, actually. Mm. And Buddy305LUV said he'd be interested in it. If he had the 65-inch version for his bedroom. So there you go. You know, the people who would make use of it and others who, you know, it doesn't really fit their use case. So I guess, Doug, if you're interested, I can have a word with LG if you like. They'll maybe knock a tenner off the 27 grand one for you. As soon as it's you. Right, so let's move on to a quick display review now. I've been looking at my first Panasonic this year. Like Jules was mentioning before, if you're a movie fan, if you want accuracy, and most of us do here, we're all film fans, we want to see things as they were mastered and intended to be seen. Panasonic have been knocking out of the park in that regard for a long time now. I remember doing some consultation for them back probably 2009, when they wanted to know more about, you know, what is this calibration thing that you're banging on about in your reviews? What can we do to improve our TVs? And they had input from AV forums and other bodies like THX and so on at the time. And, you know, they got behind the calibration side, obviously from the professional side as well. And, you know, Panasonic, maybe people don't realize Panasonic do a lot of professional gear, a lot of professional monitors and cameras and that kind of thing. So, you know, they had a foot in the door anyway. So their TVs are very, very accurate. Is what I'm getting at, basically. And they can be calibrated incredibly well as well. Their engineers take a long time in development. They are really interested in picture quality. They take feedback very serious. They will look at issues and try and figure out things and try and fix items or look at a display technology like OLED. And it was those very engineers that came up with the heat sinks. You know, how do we improve brightness on an OLED? Let's introduce a heat sink and dissipate the heat, and then you can drive it a little bit harder and you're able to dissipate that heat so there's not as much image retention and so on. They're also very good with their picture processing. The HCX processor that's on the Panasonic TVs is very good, very powerful, just above black jewels. I think this is the main area for
Panasonic. Yeah, it's always been a struggle, hasn't it? Just above black for all OLED manufacturers.
Yeah. Panasonic, their engineers, you know, when they get given a task, they do work at it till they find the solution, and they have found solutions to those problems. So the 980, which is the TV I looked at, the AMZ 980, the biggest screen size is 55. So it's available in a 42, 48, 55. It's very much the mid-range model. There is no heat sink on this one. It is an OLED EX panel, but the one without the heat sink. So very much a mid-range TV. There is gaming support on there. So there's two HDMI 2.1 ports at 40 gigabits per second. Not full bandwidth, but actually the latest consoles don't need that kind of bandwidth. And I'd surmise that very few gaming PC users would also be pushing that kind of bandwidth. So at 40 gigabits per second, it's not really a big issue. Having just two probably is an issue. And it's one thing I would like all manufacturers to look at, because TCL have done it. So I don't know why other manufacturers can't make it work on their silicon and chip. And that's to move EARC onto one of the HDMI 2.0 ports. So you're not taking up one of your 2.1 ports, which majority of TVs do. If you've got two 2.1 ports and you've got a soundbar and you want to use EARC, you lose one of your 2.1 inputs. And if you've got both next-gen consoles, it's a bit of a headache. TCL have gotten around it. The 845 sitting next to me, they've moved EARC onto one of the HDMI 2.0 ports, and it's possible. You can do it. So why other manufacturers don't do it, I don't know. So that would be one bit of feedback. But in terms of movie performance, with SDR content, this TV is exceptionally good. And most OLED TVs are with SDR content, but Panasonic, they do it right. It looks accurate. It looks fantastic in filmmaker mode. You can calibrate it within an inch of its life, down to ease of 0.4 on average, which you're not seeing any issues on screen. Even if you've got well-trained eyes, you ain't seen anything, any errors on screen. You're seeing it as it was intended to be seen for a consumer display anyway. Just above black was excellent. Black performance up from an OLED is excellent. Peak brightness, not huge, just over 600 nits, which is round about where this level of the market is at the moment. But of course, you've got that infinite contrast of OLED. You've got pixels that can be switched off and on right next to each other. You don't have zones or local dimming or anything like that. So you have that huge dynamic range to work from. And the one thing that Panasonic does really well is the tone mapping. And they do the tone mapping to the master and display metadata. So whatever the content was mastered at, they tone map to that. Whereas some manufacturers like Hisense behind me, they will do 600 nits and then hard clip. And it doesn't matter what content you then feed it, apart from Dolby Vision, which is dynamic metadata, any other HDR10 content you feed the Hisense, it'll clip, and it'll clip that detail away. Whereas Panasonic work it on the mastering metadata, so it's then tone mapped. So you don't lose as much of that highlight detail. And you certainly don't affect the APL of the scene either. So Panasonic do that very well. So it might just be 600 nits odd of peak brightness. But as I always say in the reviews, peak brightness is just one small part of what makes up a great HDR image. There are other aspects to that, as well as color and how they set tone maps and so on. So in terms of pricing, it is a little bit steep, but again, it's a brand new set just coming to market. And all the TVs this year have a small premium added to them. It's like everything else in life at the minute. As soon as you mention the words inflation, everybody seems to add a few quid onto their products. And that's certainly what we've seen this year with the TV prices as well. So compared to last year's models, it is a little bit more pricey. The other thing is 55 inches is your maximum screen size at this point of the market. I believe last year's 980 went to 65. So Panasonic are definitely trying to add some tiers into their lineup this year, because the MZ 1500, the 1500 and the 2000 always shared the same panel, the same panel with a heat sink and so on. It was just cosmetically there was a slight difference in design. The 1500 didn't have any of the built-in speakers. The 2000 had Dolby Atmos upfires, sidefires, and speaker bar. That's not the case this year. The 1500 has the heat sink, but it doesn't have a micro lens array. MLA is reserved for the 2000, so there is a distinct difference between the top range model and the next one down the second tier model, the 1500. So again, looking at the 980, you can see then why Panasonic have taken the 65 out of that range. It's to encourage people to upsell or upsell them to the 1500 at 65 inches. So you can see why, as a business, Panasonic have decided to make those changes that they have. Whether we agree with them or not as enthusiasts is another story. But it's a good set. It's it's a badge winner, 8 out of 10. And again, I'm trying to be a little bit meaner with the scores this year, so there's a little bit of meaning in the scores. So 8 out of 10 is not a bad TV. People seem to think 7, 8 out of 10 is bad. No, it's not. It's very, very good. And that's taken into consideration its price point and market level as well. So yeah, cracking TV. If you're looking at that level, you can't quite stretch the 1500 or the 2000, but you want a Panasonic. That's the one I would recommend you go and demo, or have a look around, see if you can find last year's models. You may be able to pick up a bargain there, because there's still quite a few of them around in the marketplace at the minute. So there you go. The review is on AV Forums. You can go and check that out. Jules, anything that people need to be aware of with Panasonic TVs that I haven't covered there? Anything that you like about them, or that, you know, well, maybe people should think about?
The thing I would say about the Panasonic is I've always had a sense that they're very cinematic. That there's a real, I don't know, it's something that's not quantifiable, but you feel. You get the same thing with different projectors, you know, a JVC or a Sony, whether they have a slightly different feel to them. But whenever I see a Panasonic, I always feel it's very theatrical, it's very cinematic, and as a film, you know, as a film lover, that really appeals to me. So, I mean, we're talking about all these products we have from Sony and LG and Panasonic, and they're all fantastic, aren't they? I mean, it's so hard to put I was going to say a cigarette paper between them, but we don't want to.
you're absolutely right. I mean, we are talking about tiny little differences between, you know, these TVs. There's not a huge difference. And, you know, I think unless you have an eye for this, unless you really want the best and you're really pushing for that little bit extra, I think anybody would be happy with any of the flagship TVs in terms of picture quality this year. All the processing is excellent.
I think Phil, where there is some slight differences where people might feel a little bit more strongly one way or the other is the operating systems, you know, and how easy is it to get what you want, you know, to find Netflix, to you know, to put your find the content on a USB stick or whatever. How easy are they? Everybody's going to have a their own favorite for that.
Yeah, and again, that's something that, you know, if I was to go into that in the review would be 17 pages long. Because there's so many permutations of how you're going to use the display. But that is something to think about. Is the UIs and the OSs, and Panasonic still using My Home Screen, which is now into version 8, and I've always found it really simple and easy to use. And I think they're in onto a win or the other. I think when you start overcomplicating these things, you start losing the mass market, which is where you make your money. You've got a nice, easy to use system that just works. And Panasonic do that. They've got that. So, upcoming TV reviews, what am I working on? Well, as you can see behind me, I've got a couple that I've been really working on at the moment. The Panasonic video, by the way, will be live tomorrow on our YouTube channel. So, if you want to see the video of the MZ980, it will be on their YouTube channel tomorrow. The settings video is already up there. So, like you can see behind me here, I've got the TCL C845. Got that side by side with the Hisense U8K. This Hisense arrived today. Arriving tomorrow is the Panasonic MZ2000, a 55 inch. I have a 55 inch LG G3. I have a 55 inch Samsung S95C. So there is going to be some comparisons going on there. I can't get my words out tonight. So that's going to be a big review. I know a lot of people that are really interested in finding out how all these TVs stack up against each other. And of course, Sony should be with us probably the end of this month as well. So if I can try and hang on to these TVs and get them all together, that is the aim at the minute. If this one has to go back to Panasonic, I'm sure our friends at Peter Tyson, who are just up the road from me, will be able to help us out, and we'll be able to do comparisons and compare all these TVs. So I know you guys are desperate to know which one is best for you, and we'll try and find all that out. So those are the reviews that I have coming up in terms of TV. So keep your eyes peeled and churning them out at the moment. As you can see, there's been quite a few reviews coming up. This is, we're tailing off now into the end of the TV season. There's just Philips and Sony to come now. So, you know, we'll keep you tuned as to what's happening there. And then, of course, you've got Black Friday coming soon as well, where you can get your bargain. So which TV is it you're going to go for? We'll have all of that for you. Right, so that's the TV section rounding up. Sorry you've had to listen to my voice all the way through it, but there you go. That these things happen. But home cinema is a bit more varied, and we're coming up to that next.
If you'd like to support the AV Forums podcast on a regular basis, then why not become a patron? Head over to patreon.com/AV Forums to sign up. You can also make a one-off donation through the Super Chat or via streamlabs.com/AV Forums. All donations help us to improve the website and the podcasts. Thank you to all our supporters.
Okay, so home cinema section, we've got a busy section here to get through, which is good because we haven't got a hi-fi section tonight. So we're going to spend a little bit of time on home cinema. First of all, we've got some home cinema news, and Ian, tell us all about it.
Kicking off, we've got Denon has announced a new collection of S-Series AVRs and an amplifier to go with it, all coming out in September, so keeping with our current theme of new kit coming out next month. We will be seeing the AVR S770H offering up a 7.2 setup priced at £699. It'll be joined by the 5.2 channel AVR 670H, which will be priced at £599. And they will also be joined by a 5.2 channel AVC S670H amplifier that will be priced at £549. All of them come into the S series, which is a 8K friendly range. And along with a bunch of other upgrades, with a bunch more details related to the specific models up on the website now, if you want to check it out.
Excellent. So both Doug and Martin cover AVRs as well. So Doug, what's your thoughts on the Denon lineup?
I like the look of them, actually. I'm always mindful of the fact that enthusiasts like ourselves can kind of lose sight of the mainstream market. And the fact these perfectly cater to that, really, and at their price point, if you add on a reasonably entry level multi-channel speaker package, they're probably price comparable with sound, like your higher end soundbars. And I suspect a multi-channel speaker package coupled with one of these would wipe the floor with most soundbars for the same sort of money. Obviously it takes up a lot more room and it's less aesthetically pleasing, but that seems to be where they're positioned. And having owned and tested several Denons, they're rock solid, and all the sort of independent measuring of them shows that they're really clean as well. So they're a really clean front end, they're rock solid. This is probably going to surprise all the features that most consumers need unless they're enthusiasts. So I kind of begs the question, well, what more do you really need to spend? And I think Denon look to be nailing it with this range, actually.
Martin, are people still buying AVRs, given that soundbars seem to be the flavour of the month and you can plug all your sources into those and they do streaming and all the rest of it? Do you really need an AVR these days?
Well, it's funny because I think 5.1 channel home cinemas aren't really in the public vernacular anymore. I mean, people just don't seem to know about it, talking to people, you know, in the street and people who see my system. But I think a good receiver like these, well-priced receivers, will sound infinitesimally better than a soundbar. And I've generally found soundbars, for what you're paying is a little underwhelming, even though some of them perform very well within their own categories. But yeah, I think this is really great. I mean, if you can hide those two surround speakers and keep everything up front near the TV, there's no reason to not go down this route. And as Doug says, I think they'll sound very fine for the money.
Excellent. So no doubt we will be getting these in for review. Don't know if Martin or Doug's going to do them yet. We'll cross that bridge when we get some samples through. But yeah, we will definitely be covering that range. Anything else news-wise, Ian?
Yeah, probably not been a great month for Disney. One of the things they did was to announce a new ad-supported tier for Disney Plus, while rather subtly bumping up the monthly subscription fee for those who want to keep watching in 4K and Dolby Atmos. But it's also announced that it will be ceasing distribution of Blu-rays and DVD discs in Australia. The last physical disc the company shipped out there was the recent release of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, with Disney pointing to a not entirely unexpected drop-off in sales of DVDs and Blu-rays in the region, something which has also happened in the likes of Asia and Latin America, with the same result happening. Sales in Europe and the US are faring a little better, so physical copies will continue here for the time being, but it does raise more than one sort of discussion point as to whether Disney and other companies are going to be going fully digital in the not-too-distant future, and if they do, whether, you know, the independent market will step up and fill the void, assuming that the demand for these physical discs remains.
Yeah, it's the beginning of the end. Well, we've seen it coming for a while, to be honest. I mean, streaming is very dominant these days, and again, quality wise, you know, better codecs coming down the line, better compression technologies coming down the line. You can see the studios thinking, well, they don't have to have the costs of making a physical disc, having that disc pressed, having it checked, then having it repressed if there's any mistakes, then having the artwork done, then boxes and plastics. And you can see the business case for physical media perhaps not being around forever. Or will it, Doug? Because I think, do we have these boutique labels who are maybe prepared to make those investments, maybe put the special editions out, knowing that there is at least a market out there for this kind of content?
I think so, but it's increasingly niche, isn't it? It's increasingly your collectors really that actually appreciate the physical feeling of, you know, opening the box, and you know, the people with that kind of collecting mentality will always want something physical to put on the shelf. So that will never die really, but it will just be increasingly niche.
Yeah. Martin, what's your thoughts?
I find this incredibly sad news. And when it was announced, yes, I am a collector. I do like my movies to be on the shelf. I do also like knowing that every pixel and every bit of data is going to be ingested and interpreted by my players and preamp power amps and projectors. And I am a purist in that sense. And so I hope the studios will keep doing it. And I'm sure there are a lot who feel the same way as me. I mean, unless I had a Kaleidoscape, which to me still is like a second best to having physical media, I'm still going to be in this game and I'm still going to be collecting. And I hope there are plenty out there who will be.
And I think there will be. I don't think this is, things are going to move on, Jules. They always do.
Kaleidoscape me the £300 unit in every Sainsbury's.
Yeah. But if you just look at vinyl. Everybody said vinyl was dead and so on, but you know that's a niche market, and you're going to pay more for your disc. But then I remember paying 50 quid a laser disc back in the day. You know, I wanted physical media. I wanted it as soon as possible and in the best quality at that moment in time. And Christ, I remember a T2 box set cost me £300. Star Wars Definitive Edition on Laserdisc, that was 350 quid.
Yeah, it was.
And I didn't mind back then paying that because, A, I was a collector. I wanted this stuff, and it was the best quality. So I think it'll stay around. I think 25 quid a disc is probably gone as well. I think you're going to be looking at probably about 50 quid a disc if these boutique labels then start taking things up and so on. But at the end of the day, you're getting I think you will get a quality product. And I think if you're a collector, you just got to be a bit more choosy about what it is that you're going to spend your money on. But physical media, I don't think it's going to die. Or is it, Jules?
Well, I mean, we like things, don't we? We like having things. We like holding things. There's, you know, that aesthetic experience of your vinyl, and there'll always be an appeal to certain people for that kind of object. And it's not just about the film itself. It's the whole experience, isn't it? It's the whole thing. Having them on your shelf when they come through, get delivered through the door, is, you know, you're taking the cellophane off, whatever it is, that's always going to appeal to certain people. Now, if there's is there enough of those kind of people to warrant continued production? Probably, as you say, for the boutique. What happens in the mass market, I don't know. I mean, it's very telling that DVD is still outselling by far Blu-ray and UHD Blu-ray. So for the general public, this is not even on their Richter scale, is it? It's not even factoring.
I think as well, Martin, you know, you said Kaleidoscape second best and so on. But to be fair, you know, looking at a lot of the new compression on these services, how they can get certain quality bit rates down the pipeline now in terms of streaming, it's not bad. I mean, it's not great. There's still artifacts and stuff if you've got a keen eye for that kind of thing. And if you're watching on a, you know, 8-10 foot projector screen, you know, it will not look as good as disc. But for the vast majority of people out there with a 55, 65 inch TV, and who watch it with image smoothing switched on and that kind of thing, they're not going to care, are they?
No, I totally agree with that. And I just hope disc media stays for us fanatics in the same way that Laserdisc did during the, you know, the VHS era. It was something for collectors, and the packaging got ever more sort of ambitious and had great must-have appeal. I do think one thing that's very positive, though, I guess, in particularly in the 4K UHD arena as well, is that the studios are outsourcing a lot of their content to these third party, these boutique labels, and they're doing a wonderful job with a lot of this stuff. My only slight beef with all of that is that a lot of the 4K UHD titles coming out, and I'm sure you've all noticed this, are kind of these rather obscure horror movies and a lot of films I've never heard of. And I would just wish there was a little bit more of the mainstream, and particularly movies from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But, you know, beggars can't be choosers.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we're going to come back to this subject quite a bit as we go forward over the months and years ahead. And, of course, the other one is, if you rely on streaming services, who's to stop those streaming services suddenly taking content away? At least if you own something and it's sitting on your shelf, it's not going anywhere. And that's the problem with some of these streaming services. But we're going to come back to this a little bit later on, no doubt. Right, so move things on, because I am conscious that somebody's going training tonight, football training. So we're going to jump forward to our home cinema discussion and quickly go through something that is causing confusion, is a great tool, but do people understand it? And is it really going to replace somebody as competent as Jules in the future, or do we still need competent calibrators? Well, we're talking about Kalman AutoCal, and I guess where the confusion lies, Jules, is with a lot of people using things like Dirac and so on, AutoCal systems for audio and so on, where you press a button and it takes all the measurements of the room and then applies, you know, it does mathematical equations and applies a fix for your room. AutoCal for video is not the same, is it?
No, but I mean, actually, you know what? Even in that analogy, I would say, look, with Dirac, if you just press go, you're not going to get the best of results. You need to interpret the graphs, and you need to be able to dive in there and make some judgments on what it's doing. And it's the same with the video side of things as well. Kalman AutoCal is obviously it's quite different in its different iterations. Whether it's an LG display or a Sony display or a Panasonic display, it's not the same per display. It operates in different ways. So the LG AutoCal gives you the possibility to do 3D LUT calibrations, which is brilliant. You know, that's a real step forward. And LG have captured a lot of the post-production market for client monitors because they're offering 3D LUTs in the actual display itself. So but
just for people who are listening and don't understand what a LUT is, if you're a photographer or videographer, you will know. It's obviously a lookup table. But just explain what that does and why that's important and why LG are doing it the right way.
Yeah, well, it's taking color as a volume. So color is three-dimensional. If you look at a CIE chart, it's a two-dimensional slice through your color, which shows you your saturations and your hue. But the third element is always luminance. So if you could map what the display is doing to your colors three-dimensionally, taking those things into account, you would end up with a 3D cube. And the traditional color management systems don't allow you to really deal very well with any inconsistencies within the cube. So there are many displays which are very quite non-linear in how they are dealing with the colors. And a traditional color management system allows you to calibrate a hue, a saturation and luminance, but only at one point of measurement. And the calibration that you make at that point to correct that point is only as good as the TV is as linear. So when you're able to measure through thousands of points of luminance, saturation and hue, as you do with a 3D LUT, and then to correct that volumetric through the whole the color volume of the display, you get an infinitely more accurate color on the display in the end. So 3D LUT is something which is very, very valued in post-production to get the most accurate color on monitors. And LG offers the ability through the Kalman AutoCal to actually do that on their displays.
Yeah. So you know, I think one of the misconceptions is that AutoCal will replace calibrators. That's not the case. The whole purpose of AutoCal was to do these calculations, to help the calibrator, to speed up the process. Because what you're talking about there is thousands of measurements, potentially thousands of measurements. And to do that manually or as a calibrator in the past meant hours. And even with some of the older automated systems, you could set it away and come back 8 hours later, and it was still doing measurements and adjustments and so on. So the whole purpose of AutoCal, whether it's for a Panasonic, whether it's for an LG or other displays, and most of the displays now do feature it, it gives you that instant, fast response to, I need to calibrate the grayscale. It goes away and it does it for you. But you still need to check the results. You still need to check that the measurements are right. And this is the case for all of these systems. I usually have a nightmare with them because, unlike yourself, Jules, who gets the update once the TVs are out there and being sold in numbers, normally I'm getting these through for review where Kalman still doesn't support it, or you're having to run last year's models profile against the TV to get it to even recognize AutoCal. I mean, the Panasonic I had in last week, it wouldn't run because it's not updated, it's not on the system yet. So, but the idea is that it performs a lot of the tedious tasks for the calibrator without wasting the calibrator's time, without wasting the client's time as well.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, when everything was manual still, you got pretty quick on a remote control, being able to dial in the white balance on an LG or a Panasonic. And but this just takes the heavy lifting out for you. It will do that, but you still have to watch what it's doing. It's not bulletproof. It's just like saying, you know, the same equation as, you know, well, autopilot means we don't need pilots in planes anymore, or VAR means we don't need referees. At the end of the day, there's still a human being at the end of the process, at the, you know, to check it through. So you need to, and they don't always work perfectly either, as you rightly say. Throughout the year, Cal might be correcting bugs within the workflow, and certain things have still yet to be made to work. So you do need a certain level of knowledge and expertise as you do that. But yeah, we have some very knowledgeable hobbyists on our forums.
Yeah. So this is what I was going to come on to next. Yeah. And this is the point that, you know, if you are interested in this in any way, mm-hmm. Lots of these TVs actually have a pattern generator built in, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. Now, to access it, you need the software from Calman. Mm-hmm. You need to go and buy that. It's about $145 to buy the software. It's a mm-hmm. one-off license. But you're buying it for your TV at the end yep. of the day, and you can run as many calibrations as you like. You can play around with the system. You can learn from it. And on top of that software, you'll need a meter of some description. But, you know, buying an inexpensive meter nowadays, you know, it's not going to be as accurate as no. the stuff I use here or the stuff that you use, Jules. Yep. But then, you know, if you're only spending a couple hundred quid on a meter, it's still quite accurate, and it's a lot more accurate than the eye will ever be. And you'll never be able to sit down and calibrate a TV by eye. Anybody that says that they can do that is talking absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
So you need the tools, but the price point's definitely coming down for those of us out there, those enthusiasts out there that want to get onto this and learn and calibrate on their own TVs and so on. So I believe it's $145 for the software. A meter nowadays, Jules, maybe 150 quid will get you a decent...
A couple hundred quid, but yeah. That will get you a colorimeter. And yeah. that will come with various profiles depending upon what display you're measuring, because you've got to take into account the spectral power distribution of each display, etc. So they'll be more or less accurate depending upon what display you're measuring. But they do drift over time because these cheaper yes. colorimeters are... tri-stimulus, so they'll have red, green, and blue filters in them, which are plastic, and they do degrade over a period of time, so they'll periodically need reprofiling against an accurate spectro.
Yeah, but if you're an enthusiast, you know, knock yourselves out, guys, because that's how I learned. It's how Jules got into it as well. Yep. You know, we went and bought, at that time there was some cheap software. In fact, I think it was free software at that time, mm-hmm. and you could go and get yourself a meter. And
yeah.
the main pain was the fact that you had to sit with a desk and move forward one chapter at a time and take yeah. a measurement, move forward, take a measurement, yeah. and then you had to take a black measurement. So you'd have to take a meter off the TV and get your black measurement and then put it back on. So it would take hours. Nowadays, you know, when it comes to testing these TVs and so on, and I know it's the same for you, Jules, it's cut so much time because everything can be automated now, and you can say, right, I want to do 20-point or 21-point grayscale, mm-hmm. off you go, and it does it for you. And then you just check the results afterwards. Yeah. It's so much easier.
On the other hand, we've got a lot more picture modes to calibrate now.
Exactly.
So I'm potentially doing 7 on an LG, you know, so you've got SDR, bright, dark, game, HDR, mm-hmm. HDR game, Dolby Vision game. You know, each one of those is taking 40 minutes, so it can take you, you know, still a good 4 or 5 hours to calibrate one.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the beauty is, like I say, some of these TVs do have pattern generators built in, because a pattern generator is a fairly expensive piece of kit. I mean, certainly the 7G that I'm using, you're using a 7G as well, aren't you, these days?
Yeah, I've got 7G. Yeah.
$5,000 for one of them.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money if you're not doing it professionally. So the fact that a lot of these TVs do have a pattern generator built in, that the software can talk to the TV and say, bring up this pattern and take the measurement and so on. So even, you know, for the consumer level, the enthusiast level, things have improved greatly, and the, you know, the price point has come down. So AutoCal, it's not there to replace the calibrator. You can't replace that knowledge, that expertise. What it does is it makes the job a lot easier. It takes a lot of the heavy workload and heavy lifting away, and allows the calibrator to spend more time fine-tuning the image and getting something as accurate as possible. And of course, in a professional sense as well, Jules, you know, a lot of these studios and so on, with the technicians, they might have 30, 40 monitors a night that they have to go over and double check and make sure they're still correct. So something as quick as this that takes the heavy lifting out is well worth it. So, like I say, most TVs nowadays, and any TV that now has the new Pentonic chips, automatically have access to this if the manufacturer wants it. They have access to AutoCAL now. So it used to be if a manufacturer wanted AutoCAL, they had to go and work with portrait displays for sometimes a couple of years before they would have something that was workable and could be released to the public. Now with the new silicon, they're able to do that really quite quickly now. So I think you'll find most TVs will do it these days. In fact, I can't think of any TVs that don't do it now. So yeah, there you go. And I think Jules needs to go and do his training. So Jules, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure. And we'll catch up with you on the next podcast. So good night, Jules.
Cheers, guys.
Right, so moving on, let's go and do a little bit more news, and let's get Ian back again, because the news we've got now is that we've got a couple of new reviewers joining the AV Forums team. They're not on the podcast tonight, but we thought it would be worthwhile just letting you know that we do have new reviewers coming on all the time, people to help us cover this hobby of ours. And one side that we are definitely spending a lot of time on at the moment and trying to get our content up is the gaming side of things, Ian, which is it's always been your side of things, games. So we've got a couple of new reviewers. Why don't you introduce some, let us know a little bit about the background and what they'll be covering the weeks ahead.
Yeah, looking to put a few more people together so that obviously we can increase the number of reviews on a more regular basis, as you say. First up, we've got a guy called Seth Grimes, who coincidentally graduated the same degree course as I did, multimedia journalism. Although, obviously, he did it at a different university and a good few years after I did it. He's primarily a PC gamer, which should help to broaden our horizons, given my rather obvious Xbox bias over the past year or so. He's big into sports games, been doing a lot of work with an online sports gaming site. And I do suspect that the two of us could talk about Football Manager for quite some time. And he also seems to be quite big on fighting games, which is good because I'm terrible at them, so generally don't like them. So it could help us get a few more fighting games onto the site, with one eye on the likes of Mortal Kombat coming out quite shortly. He's already got the first couple of reviews up on the site if you want to take a look. Factory automation game Tectonica, which is out now on PC and Xbox, early access or game previews, reviewed that one. It's also a review of the new F1 Manager 2023, which basically takes the creator team aspect of the Formula One racing franchise and just really runs with it to a whole new level. Coming up on his radar, I think he's looking at Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's a bit of a film tie-in in the upcoming week. I think that's out at the end of this week, so I just hope he's not too influenced by the games that he plays. Also joining teams, a new guy called Mohammed Hamid. He's been working in video games for like 10 years, even though he still looks barely old enough to be playing games for that long. He's worked on a lot of sort of Nintendo and PlayStation outlets. He also has had his own YouTube channel for a fair chunk of that time as well. So he's got quite a flair for the creative side of gaming. Seems to be into sort of RPGs and those kind of immersive action adventure games, which is good because they take hours to play. So I'm quite happy to delegate a few of those to other people. He's also on PC as well as the main consoles, and obviously his Nintendo influence will help with the Switch titles, hopefully. As for his first review, Remnant 2 went up on the website today, I think, so that's worth a look if you're into those kind of quite immersive Souls-like action games. And he's also got a potentially glaring review of Baldur's Gate 3 on the way as well. So that should be up on the site hopefully sometime soon. And a little bit further down the line, I think he's kind of voiced an interest in Armored Core 6, which is coming out a little bit later in the month as well. So long story short, it's going to be a lot of more gaming content going up on the site. More reviews up on there now to take a look if you want to, and hopefully a lot more to come in the near future.
Yeah, excellent. And of course, your feedback as well, listener. If you're interested in that kind of thing, if you think there's an area that AV Forums could look at in terms of reviews and so on, then let us know. We're always keen for your feedback. We're always keen to build the team and make sure that we're covering everything that you guys want to know about. And of course, we're in the unique position that we do have access to lots of areas of the industry. So yeah, if there's anything that you think we should be covering or looking at and so on. And again, the team that exists already, we are also looking at expanding some of the knowledge base of the team as well and introducing new reviews. So both Doug and Martin will be dabbling with some display tech going forward. Doug's mentioned that he'd like to do some PC monitors and gaming monitors and that kind of thing in the future. And Martin's going to look at some projectors as well. So So yeah, anything that you think we should be expanding the team to do, or should be looking at that you think we're maybe not quite covering, then let us know. Or anything else regarding AV forums that you like or you think we can improve on, let us know in terms of the feedback. You can do that underneath this podcast in the podcast forum. And again, we'll come back and mention those things in future podcasts. Now, to wrap up tonight, we're going to get serious with audio. Unfortunately, Ed's ill, and we do wish him a speedy recovery, so there's no hi-fi to talk about, but we do have plenty of home cinema sound to talk about, and we haven't really been talking much about home cinema sound on the podcast. You know, getting Doug and Martin together has been, because of busy lifestyles and everything else and so on, it's been difficult getting the two guys on together, but we have them this evening, so we're going to take full advantage of it, because they have been looking at audio products. We're going to start with Doug. Now, a brand that I've known about for such a long time, yet had very little in terms of actual listening experience and so on, and that's Klipsch. The Reference Premier Home Cinema Speaker Package, you looked at that a few weeks back. Tell us all about that. Tell us about the kit and tell us about Klipsch a little bit, because I think they're still a bit of an unknown in the UK.
Yeah, they're fairly dominant in the US market, I gather. They've been around for donkey's years. I'm not quite sure how long they've been around, but they're famed for their horn technology. I think they call it the Tractrix horn geometry. And so all their speakers, going back to the very original iteration, use these compression drivers and horn arrangements, and are known for being incredibly sensitive speakers, meaning that they are very easy to drive with lower powered amplifiers. Even their very large speakers are highly efficient. Now there's a slight question mark about the way Klipsch measure their efficiency. It's slightly different to the way other manufacturers do, so they probably slightly overstate their efficiency. But the kind of bottom line is Klipsch are known to be highly dynamic, highly efficient speakers and horn based. And similar to you, actually, I've known about Klipsch for as long as I've been into AV, really, but I've never really had much opportunity to listen to them, and certainly never in my own home. I've listened to the Klipsch Cornwalls, which are these big wardrobe size speakers that you know, very, very famous and much loved among Klipsch fans. But I've never listened to their more sort of domestic AV offerings. So I was very interested to get these in the house and give them a whirl. And the Reference Premier is really their main AV offering. And as a range, it's huge. There are lots of different speakers. So pretty much any permutation for your living arrangements that you need, you can probably find it with the Reference Premier system. And the setup I reviewed was towards the kind of upper end of the Reference Premier range. It was the RP8060 FA2, doesn't really roll off the tongue, floor standers, which are dual 8-inch woofers, again with that horn-based arrangement for the tweeter. The RP504 center, the RP502 S2 surrounds, which are dipole surrounds. And for those of you who don't know what dipole surrounds are, they're essentially side firing. So they're slightly triangular, and they have a woofer that fires in one direction, a woofer that fires in the other direction, and tweeter that does the same, fire in opposite directions. And the distinction between dipole speakers and bipole speakers is bipole speakers do the same, but dipoles, the woofers, the opposite sides are out of phase with one another, which the effect that creates is it creates a slight null in the frequency response directly on axis in front of the speaker. And the idea behind dipole sort of theory is that when you're sat in that null, when you're sat on axis to the speaker, you find it difficult to localize where the sound is coming from. So the theory is that they create a much more immersive ambient surround field where you struggle to localize the speaker. and I've got some thoughts on that, which I'll come to later. And the other part of the package was their 12-inch RP1200SW subwoofer, which is relatively short and not terribly wide, but possibly the deepest subwoofer that I have reviewed, certainly other than the, you know, the behemoths like the large Pelican. I think it was 65 centimeters, slightly over 65 centimeters deep, which, and it's when you look at it, it's just it's long. It's a very weird shape for a subwoofer. So for some people that might be easy to accommodate, for others it'd be very awkward. So really, you know, have a think about its depth before you buy one of these. In terms of design, as I said, the standard Klipsch horn arrangement with their orange, their copper colored woofers, which are ceramic, I think it's aluminium, composite ceramic and aluminium, and that's a trademark of Klipsch. Pretty well all their speakers have those copper colored woofers. The really interesting part about the system, and the thing that one of the reasons I really wanted to have a play with it, is the floor standards are up firing, so the Atmos bounce speakers that sort of fire the sound. They have an up firing woofer and tweeter at the top of the speaker, and that fires against the ceiling, reflects off the ceiling down to the listener, and it's intended to create Atmos top height level effect. But the interesting thing about the Klipsch is, being as their horn arrangement, you use that horn to fire against the ceiling, and that controls the directivity slightly better than your typical sort of flat tweeter would, which sort of spreads sound energy like all over the place. The horn focuses it, so theoretically that should work really well with the bounce arrangement, because it's more laser-like, as it were. I mean, it's not quite, but you get the point. So I really wanted to have a play with that. And so overall, the performance, I'd say, is they're very natural sounding speakers. They're not, one might get the impression from sort of reading about Klipsch and knowing that they're high sensitivity horn-based speakers, that they might be quite shouty, because horn-based speakers have that sort of reputation historically. They are absolutely not shouty in the least. They're very smooth sounding for the most part, very natural sounding, quite detailed, and very, very dynamic. I did find there was a little bit of high frequency harshness on occasion, not quite shoutiness, but just a little bit of harshness. And that I noticed in the Jenny Lind Never Enough song in The Greatest Showman, which people probably heard a million times. And you really need to, any speaker that is susceptible at all to any form of harshness, that will reveal it. And it did with Klipsch, and it was a little bit edgy, but as I say, not terribly offensively so. The detail could have been a little bit better. There were a couple of places where I noticed that it sounded a little bit recessed, more recessed than I've heard on other systems. So Ready Player One, the race scene, I use specifically for that sort of detail resolution, detail retrieval, because it's in an incredibly detailed scene. There's just loads going on. And there's a particular scene where Wade slides his car under a truck and then collects a bunch of coins that'd be sort of emitted of the previously departed contestant. And that just didn't sound anywhere near as detailed as I've heard it before. There's on the one hand, they can be slightly harsh, but on the other hand, they're not that detailed, which is a strange combination. Bass and mid-range, absolutely fantastic. So pretty much the whole range that those composite woofers are covering, just beautiful, like really, really refined. They really nailed their woofers there. The sub, again, yeah, good, really impactful. Didn't really dig as deep as some of the other subs that I've tested, but you know, I've noted in many of my reviews that I'm actually more interested in that sort of transient base impact than I am in the outright depth, the sort of infrasonic stuff. The infrasonic stuff's incredibly hard to do unless you throw tens of thousands of pounds at it, frankly. So I'm more interested in that upper base, the transient impact, and the Klipsch sub did it very well. The standout sort of feature of its performance was the bounce. They've nailed it. I've heard upfirers both in my room, outside my room, like several times, never heard it as good as the Klipsch. It's almost uncanny how they can convey specific objects above your head. I mean, it's never going to be as good as actual speakers physically located on the ceiling. It's more of an approximation of that effect, but it's pretty close, to the point where if you're not an enthusiast, I think that's probably going to be enough for you, really. So, you know, even if you are an enthusiast, it might well be enough for you. It depends how, you know, averse you are to putting speakers in your ceiling, which are not always easy to accommodate. So overall, they sounded fantastic. I had a little bit of a beef with some of the harshness. My main sort of gripe, which I had in the review, is the floor standards are around about 3K. And as with the entire system, they use sort of vinyl wrap for their cabinets. Just not really happy with black vinyl wrap on a three grand pair of speakers, really. Do better than that, and other manufacturers manage to with wood veneer or high quality paint finishes, and this just felt a little bit cheap.
Well, if people want more, and it's great getting you know, your thoughts, Doug, in person, because you know you only get so much from the written word, but if people want to read the written word, it's up there. The review is on the website. I believe it is published mid-July, maybe. So if you're having trouble finding it, you can find it around about mid-July. We're going to come back to Doug for another speaker review very soon, but we're going to pop over to Martin because these speakers need something to drive them, and you've been looking at an 8-channel power amp. Tell us all about it, Martin.
Yeah, so 8 channels is a little less regular, I think, for a home cinema amplifier, and you assume this is where this amp is directed. Although manufacturers are thinking in terms of 16 now, 16 channels for a 9.6, for example, home cinema. So 8+8 seems as good a choice as any. But this 8-channel amplifier comes from Swedish firm Primair, who've been around since 1985. They don't have many AB products, but the SPA25 is a home cinema integrated amp, which might be interesting to listen to at some point. And this kind of is a partner product in the same range, if you like. But obviously, it's got the SPA25 has 9 channels of amplification on board. And you can use a further 2 to get a 7.1.4 Dolby Atmos sound field. So that is the SPA25. We're dealing with the A35.8. It comes in at £4,500. It has a nice black brushed steel front with the Primair logo, which is etched into the center. And just above is a nice little triangular LED light to let you know that the amp is indeed on. There's only 3 steel feet under the casing, which is a bit disconcerting. So while you're connecting your cables, it can have a tendency to tip if you put too much pressure on one side or the other. But it's relatively light at 15 kilograms and not as deep as many Class AB rivals, which is a nice thing about Class D architectures in general. The 1500 watt A35.8 uses a Class D architecture as stated, and they are comprised of Hypex Encore N500 modules. Primair boasts the most direct delivery and distribution of power from the power supply to the modules, which themselves are buried in the heat sinks. Both input and output stages are isolated from any noise that the modules might produce. So they put a lot of thought into the layout of the internals of these amplifiers. So there is a lot of versatility in terms of connections, how you want to do your arrangement in your home cinema or even in your music system. You can use it as a 2.0 channel system with all pairs of inputs bridged for 750 watts per pair into 8 ohms. So I don't know how likely it is that a music enthusiast would use this amp purely as for biamping of a pair of speakers, but it is an option. I think you'll find most buyers for this amplifier will be in a home cinema context. With two of the amps, you could just bridge the center in a 9.x.6 config, or bridge left, center, right, and just one, and use just a pair of unbridged outputs for surround. And actually, I did use this amp in bridged and unbridged modes with my LCR speakers. And consequently, much bigger impact and heft, I suppose, would be a good word, by bridging my left, center, and right. But generally, I found the sound stage was big and open. Drums and bass have brutal but honed attack. The timing is superb, with what I describe as bursting transients in every bar of music. The imaging is laser-like, and there's even great depth of field or sound staging. It sometimes feels like you're even in the studio or venue, which I was amazed at. I should say the soundstage is quite forward. It's quite in your face. But I find that simply perfect for movies, even over prolonged listening. And I didn't get any of that sense of brightness that I've heard with other Class D amps, which can even be fatiguing. And I didn't get any of that. And I have to say, I'm a bit blown away. I thought this amp sounded truly wonderful, and I gave it 10 out of 10, best in class, because I thought it sounded wonderful.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, again, the review is up there. This was a more recent one, wasn't it? Beginning of August,
yeah,
maybe?
Friday of last week, yeah.
Yeah, so if you're interested in that one, go have a read. And if you've got any questions for Martin, then shove them onto the review there. I think there's a decent conversation going already in the discussion thread. So if you've got any questions, I'm sure Martin, when he's got 5 minutes spare, will pop through and answer those for you. Right, so just to wrap up tonight on our reviews, let's head back to Doug. Now, this is a brand that I'm not familiar with. Obviously, I spend more of my time these days with TVs in front of me rather than speakers and amplifiers. So maybe tell us about Ascendo. Who are they? What do they do? And what was it that you looked at?
Okay. So Ascendo, they've been around for quite a while. They used to, a long time ago, focus on sort of rather esoteric hi-fi speakers, the sorts of speakers that they would demonstrate at the Munich high-end hi-fi show. And outside of those kind of high-end hi-fi aficionados, they weren't terribly well known, but they have over the past few years branched out into home theater in a big way. And the way most people, and the way I came to hear of Ascendo in the first place, is by seeing one of their subwoofers. And if you look at the review, you can see a picture of the 50-inch subwoofer, which was the first time I ever came across Ascendo. I was at a hi-fi show and I walked past the 50-inch subwoofer and I stopped in my tracks and wondered, hang on about, who's this? Who's producing a 50-inch subwoofer? So that's how most people tend to come across Ascendo. They now have a huge portfolio of specifically home theatre targeted speakers and subwoofers, and they rebranded as Ascendo Immersive Audio. And the way they do things is unlike anyone, I think I would probably go as far as saying, in that their speakers, which are mostly very high end and sort of custom installation focused, tend to, at the upper end, be active, or with their own inbuilt amplification. And their subwoofer range, they divide in two. So they have subwoofers, which I think they like to call kick subs. Most people would just call them subwoofers, that play the range around sort of 27 hertz and up. And they have infrasonic subs, which play below that, down to single digits. And the 50 inch, as you might imagine, it falls into the infrasonic subwoofer category. They actually make an 80 inch as well, which is so obscenely ridiculously large. That,
yeah, but you could feel like Marty McFly, though, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They don't even make a cabinet for it. That's how big it is. So if you want it in your cinema, they have to build a room for it. It's like a cement bunker that they have to build for the rear of it. So it's only for the most obscenely, ridiculously multi-million pound home theatre installations that that's aimed at. This package that I tested was, to coin Ed Selly's in his absence term, slightly more terrestrial or terrestrial adjacent, as he likes to say, in that it's still a 10 grand speaker package, but it's nowhere near the cost of, you know, it as a package, it's still not as expensive as their entry level infrasonic sub. So it's very much entry level in Ascendo terms. It's still very expensive, so most people wouldn't regard it as entry level. And the system I tested was their 10 inch passive on walls, or they can be used in wall as well, and their 6.5 inch surrounds, had four of those, used as surround backs, and two 12 inch subs, which at the time of review was called the SV12, but they've since rebranded to call it the 12 sub, so there's no real imagination really in their naming convention. There's the 10p is the 10 inch passive, the 6p is the 6.5 inch passive, and the 12 inch subs. So aside from their sort of twin approach to infrasonic and kick subs, the other very unusual thing about Ascendo speakers is, well, twofold. One, they are absolutely ridiculously efficient, and their output is like, short of going for actual pro cinema speakers, I don't think you can get this sort of output at the price. I think the Ascendo, the 10p is probably the highest output speaker at this price. Someone will probably find another speaker that I'm not thinking of, but they are 97 dB efficient and handle up to 500 watts. So if you put that into any sort of SPL calculator, you realize that pretty well at any reasonable listening distance, you can hit THX reference 105 dB with quite a lot of headroom. So they're a staggering amount of output. The 6.5 inch, they will hit THX reference levels at a 3 meter listening distance. These are tiny. They're actually 88 millimeters deep that go on the wall, and they will hit reference levels at that sort of distance. And that's output that most speakers can't keep up with, really. Unless you spend serious money. Most home theater speakers just don't have that sort of output. And the Ascendos do, and they're relatively entry-level priced. The trade-off for that is they roll off their bass at around 80 hertz. They don't attempt to produce any bass, being as they're a subsat system. They're purely intended for use with the subwoofer. So that's probably a worthwhile trade-off in my view, because you should be using subwoofers, certainly in a home theater system. And I'd rather have the higher output capability with the headroom. And that's the Ascendo approach. The other really interesting part of their design is they are all coaxial drivers. And what that means is Tannoy have been doing this for years. So Kef do it as well. are famed for their coaxial drivers. So what a coaxial driver essentially is it locates the high frequency transducer in the middle of the low frequency woofer. Usually it fires through an acoustically transparent dust cap in the center of the woofer. And all the Ascendo speakers do that. There are two big benefits of that. One is the single point source is geometrically symmetrical in every direction. And so sound radiates symmetrically in every direction, slightly different on axis, just because the design of the transducer. But everything other than on axis, it's symmetrical. And one of the big advantages of that is they're incredibly easy and amenable to EQ, because if you change the frequency response in one direction, the mirror image happens at the opposite direction. So you can EQ every direction sort of simultaneously. So what you find is when you try and EQ them, they respond almost perfectly to the changes, which isn't the case with most other speakers. It's a bit of trial and error. The other big benefit of the point source, which Ascendo are at pains to explain, is traditional speakers locate the tweeter and the woofer separately. And what that results in is very slight timing differences in the time it takes for the sound from those two drivers to reach your ear, depending on where you're sitting relative to those two drivers, because there's sort of path distance between the distance from those two drivers will change depending on where you're sitting, and which means the timing will change ever so slightly. And what Ascendo say, and they make a very compelling argument around this, is that the human ear uses timing differences to locate things in space, to spatially localize things. You hear the difference in time between your two ears that a sound takes, and then you can position it fairly accurately. Normally on the horizontal plane is where you're most accurate. And the human ear is incredibly acute at its ability to position things. And Ascendo would argue that the slight timing differences you get with conventional speakers slightly smear the cues to your ears about localization. So you can't precisely localize images as accurately with a sort of two or multi-way driver system as you can with a single point source that emanates everything in a time-coherent way from one particular source. And as a result, with the single point source speaker, they image more precisely, essentially. You're able to spatially locate objects more precisely. And I mean, that was my experience. Like, it absolutely lived up to that. In terms of the overall presentation, without EQ, I found it almost painfully bright. They definitely need EQ. They are certainly warts and all speakers. You need to tame them ever so slightly. Once tamed, they are incredibly detailed. They have this layered spatial, hugely dense sound field, unlike anything else I've tested, which is essentially what Ascendo have argued is the coaxial nature of their speakers, coupled with the high output, leads to this greater immersiveness. And as I say, that's exactly what I found. Their output capability just meant there was as much headroom on tap as, you know, any sane person could want. My ears would give in well before these would be breaking a sweat. And they do all of that in a very sort of slight form factor, very easy to accommodate in more or less any room. I mean, they're not the prettiest speakers. They are black cuboids with a black grill that goes in the front.
They remind me of the JBL Professional range. They look very, very similar with that kind of finish where they're supposed to go behind acoustically transparent screens and wall surfaces, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Essendo really grew out of the custom install market, and that's where they're really focusing a lot of their efforts and huge amounts of traction. Like Trinov are demoing their latest waveforming tech with an all Essendo system in Cedia later this year. Mm. And, you know, I think Trinov have used them for previous demos. And the custom install market love Essendo at the moment. And they are branching out steadily into the more consumer side. And this system is really evidence of that. And yeah. I can't think of a system that is price comparable that I think can equal this, really.
Do we know who's distributing them in the UK where people can probably, it's Karma AV, is it? Okay, so they should be available for people to demo, certainly through Karma. So if you are interested in that, go read Doug's review. It is up on the site. Doug, remind me when I put that up. Was that this week?
Today.
It was today, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was today.
Yeah. It's been a long. It's been
there's
a long
lots of chat already. It's got a lot of interest.
It has indeed. So yeah, thank you very much for the review. Thank you very much for your time tonight. And thanks to all the guys on the podcast tonight, including Jules, who's left there. We are out of time, unfortunately, but hopefully it's been an interesting evening for you. We have gone in a little bit more depth than we normally do with some of the subjects. If you've liked that, if you like the more in-depth look at speaker systems and so on, let us know in the feedback. It's certainly something that we can sit and talk for hours on this kind of thing. So just tell us what you want to hear and we'll sit and discuss it for hours. Looking at some of the questions that have come in tonight on the chat window before we do leave for the evening. A lot of people basically saying the same as we did during our discussion when it comes to physical media versus streaming services. A lot of comments there about how you guys love your physical media, and of course you do. We all love physical media. It's the times that we live in, unfortunately, that you know streaming is going to become the mainstream. If it's not already, it certainly is going to become the mainstream. But as fans, we should be able to keep it going, hopefully, and we should be able to keep physical media a thing. Certainly vinyl's still around a long time after everybody thought that was dead, so fingers crossed it can stay around. Other comments up there tonight. Asaf was asking what the MLA OLED is from Panasonic. That's the MZ2000. It's the one I'm going to be reviewing next, so keep your eyes open for that appearing on the site. Lots of people also saying that they love their Sonos Arc sub and you know less wires everywhere and so on. Yeah, and we all like clean installs around here as well. So yeah, thank you very much for your questions. We have seen them coming in. Apologies if I read them out one by one. We've been trying to get as much conversation going tonight as possible in terms of what we can tell you about. So hopefully you have enjoyed tonight's show. Thanks to the guys. Next AV Forums podcast is going to be the movies edition. It's along on the 21st of this month, starting at 8:30. The main AV Forums podcast, this podcast, it should have been on the 28th of the month, but obviously 28th of the month is a bank holiday, so we are not around. So this is the only podcast, main podcast for August, but we will be back on the 11th of September at 7 p.m. And before we are back on the 11th of September, you've got another movies podcast. So you're going to get two movies podcasts close to each other. That's on the 4th of September. So that's all the podcasts coming up in the near future. And like I say, if you've enjoyed this podcast, then of course, do all the cliched social media things, like, share, subscribe, all that kind of thing. Leave us a 5-star rating, leave us 10 stars. Whatever you want to do, you do it. If you enjoy it, then just let us know and we'll keep coming back every other week. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you again soon. Good night.
See you.
Bye. Bye.